Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Ask anyone who's had a major water leak, and they will tell you that most of the damage could have been prevented if they had have been able to stop the leak sooner. Groa, maker of innovative German-engineered showers and faucets, is helping busy homeowners like you prevent water damage and protect your home even when you're away. The new Groa SenseGuard is an intuitive, smart water control that detects leaks, alerts you via a smartphone app, and automatically shuts off your water supply before more damage is done. Protect your home, vacation, or rental properties with Groa SenseGuard and quickly stop water damage before a drip becomes a flood. You can save 35% on Groa SenseGuard only at groa.us/hive19. Once again, that's Groa, groa.us/hive19. Once again, groa.us/hive19. Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. So we talk a lot about 2020 and Donald Trump and the Democratic Party and who's going to win and who's going to be the nominee on the show and so on. And I figure, you know what? Why don't we actually go to someone who knows what they're talking about? So I'm very excited to welcome back to the show Jennifer Palmieri. She is the former White House Director of Communications under Obama. She was the Director of Communications for the Hillary Clinton 2016 presidential campaign. She's worked with the DNC, the White House Press Office, Panetta. I could just go on and on and on. She's incredibly smart. She has an amazing book called Dear Madam President, which we've talked about on the show about a year ago. And she knows everything that's going on in the Democratic committee right now that's trying to decide who is going to be the nominee that is going to take on Donald Trump. And she has a few theories about how this is all going to work out. Some of them are a little bit terrifying, but I'm very excited to discuss them with her. So without further ado, Jennifer Palmieri. Welcome back to the show.
I'm very happy to be back on
this
your show.
It's almost like you never left. You've been living in like the guest house for the last year and a half. And can you tell, what have you been up to since your book came out?
It was literally just about a year ago, because the book came out just about a year ago. So I was sitting here then, I think I was here last April. So the book came out.
Not a lot has changed on the Democratic side necessarily of the world, or the Republican side. Donald Trump's still a crazy, complete lunatic.
Donald Trump is still a crazy, complete lunatic, but we have had the 2018 election since
we have, that is true. I forgot about those.
Which I was really found reassuring because, as one would hope, I have to check my political instincts and gut after living through 16. And I expected that 18 would be a time where a lot of women got elected, that Democrats would do well, not as well as we would like in terms of getting the Senate back. I was optimistic, but had tempered optimism. And I feel like what I expected to have happened, which is so reassuring in these days to actually predict correctly what might happen in politics.
Well, and we're finally starting to see the results of that. This last week's show was about AOC and the impact mm-hmm. she's had. And right. Could you imagine if all you were just known as an acronym,
JMP. JP. JMP. So that's pretty good. Like jump.
NAB. We're starting to see that happen. And the question that I think a lot of us have, and why I'm so excited to have you here today, because hopefully you can shed some light, is I feel like the 2020 side for Democrats is going to look an awful lot like the 2016 side for Republicans, which allowed Donald Trump, of course, to come through the ranks. And I'm just curious, we can go through the candidates one by one and get your take on them and your optimism and whatnot. But I want to start with the big burning question rather than end with it. Is this a bad thing that we now have, 16 Democratic candidates running aren't they going to tear each other to shreds and just whoever's
no,
left?
No, I think that, if you look at history, recent history suggests that large fields benefit Democrats. The three times where we've taken the White House back in the last 50 years, so that would be 1976 with Jimmy Carter, 1992 with Bill Clinton, and 2008 with Barack Obama, we had very large fields. As a matter of fact, the largest field to date prior to this year was 16 candidates in 1976.
So we're now equal to 76.
So I think we're now equal to 76. So we're on the verge of getting. And by the way, I think the fact that we have such a large field there's a positive reflection there. I think part of the reason why we have such a big field is because it is now viable for a woman of color, any man of color, a gay man to be considered a viable president, viable candidate for president. So that is partly that's why the field is so large.
Is the field also large? 74 Nixon, 76.
I think it's like when you want to throw the whole game board up in the air and you're not really sure. You know that America's at a pivotal point, a point of inflection, but you're not sure and unclear about where we should go next. And so I think that draws a big field when the country's really wrestling with where do we go next. And, I think how we decide to replace Donald Trump is a very big question for America. So I'm glad that there's a lot of options. I think this election, even more so than, 76, it's hard to argue that was a really important election when you were coming out of the Nixon presidency. But I think how we replace Trump is a big question for the country, and it really says a lot about the kind of country we are in. And to have high quality, good candidates raises the bar on everyone, and it makes everybody better. I mean, either you rise to the level of to be able to compete with the talent that's in the field or you fall away, but it's going to make the talented candidates way better. Like 2008's a good example of that.
Do you think that I'm kind of running the show backwards at this point, but do you think that Trump might win again?
Yeah,
you do.
I do. Yeah.
You do. And do you think that that is a result of the Democrats not having their shit together, or as a result of the fact that Trump appeals to a base that is vociferous and passionate and will go to the polls to vote for him?
I think the latter. I think that he has a very strong hold on his base. I'm so concerned about the fact that we still live in two Americas of, what we can't even agree on a basis level of facts. I look at American history to guide us here about how Democratic presidential fields have performed in the past, but I'm also looking to Europe because, Donald Trump is a American phenomenon, but he's part of a, phenomenon happening in the Western world of upheaval and nationalism. So, I look at Brexit and the orange vests in France and see how those countries are reacting to that kind of frustration being expressed in their political systems. And, I think if we can be too myopic to think that this is an American thing, it's a global thing.
But isn't part of it that it's a global thing, but it is a global thing that at its root is a issue of inequality, where you have the number fluctuates, but between 4 and 6 people who have the same amount of wealth as the bottom 3.6 billion. And yet bottom 3.6 billion, specifically in America and in England and Brexit, are voting for the wrong people to fix that by putting people in power that are going to do the complete opposite of what we need to have done.
And yeah.
Isn't that something that how do the Democrats get that message across?
So I think that, I would say when I woke up on November 9th, 2016, I felt like
I drank a bottle of vodka.
I should have drank a bottle of Russian vodka.
Yeah.
I felt like I woke up into a different universe. It felt to me like the universe I had lived in before had exploded. And the way I think about that now is I think that there had been so much pressure had built up in the world, or in this country in particular, of all the inequality that became too much to bear. So you spoke of it in terms of economic inequality, you know, the growing wage gap, the richer getting richer, the poorer getting poorer. But it's also true in justice, right? There was the country was created this great premise that we were all created equal if you were, you know, a man, white, and owned land. And I just think that bill came due, right? Like, it's just like the power being concentrated in too few hands. Just people rebelled against that. And I think a big thing that I found the Clinton campaign, and I think is true today and is going to matter a lot in the 2020 presidential, is that the government has such little credibility about having the ability to make a positive difference in people's lives, right? So people think Hillary Clinton didn't have an economic agenda. She actually did have one. It was very hard to communicate about it in the din. But also, I think that even if people did hear some of the ideas, they would think, how's she ever going to get that done? Mm. How's it ever going to matter?
Yeah.
And they're not wrong about that, to have that kind of doubt about, you know, government's ability to function, Congress's ability to function in particular, I mean, and get past dysfunction to get something done. So there is this enormous, so I think that's part of the problem. And I've made a point to spend time in red states and places that I hadn't been to in a long time, like in the South and also Rocky Mountain West, and talk with Trump voters, and, you know, a lot of them say, I just wanted something different. Like, I just wanted to blow it up because nothing was working.
That I totally understand, but do they still believe in him?
Yes, I think that they get a lot of value out of the fact that Donald Trump is president of the United States.
Which is, what kind of value?
I think some people do. I think some people don't. I mean, I think some people still
believe in him. I don't get a lot of value out of it.
I don't either, as it turns out. But I think he tells them a story about America that makes sense to them, makes their lives make sense. It's validating. And I think Democrats really can discount the power of telling somebody a story, but that places them in a broader context and gives their life value. That's a big deal.
Okay, so this is a perfect segue into 2020. How do Democrats tell a story that makes sense to those voters?
There are different ways that people are trying to do that, right? So I think that, you know, what I've been struck with this week, this is the week with Beto O'Rourke got into the race, is I think what we're going to find out, and you had said before, you know, is the 2016 Republican primary going to repeat itself in the form of the 2020 Democratic presidential primary? We're going to see now, I think, does policy still matter?
Explain how, why?
Because I think that a lot of the presidential candidates, and I will say it has felt to me that up until this moment, we've been in a pre-scrimmage game, right? Mm-hmm. The battle hasn't really felt joined. And I think that's because we have a lot of candidates, they're very diverse, but it was still relatively traditional. People are playing by the relatively traditional rules of the game, right? You get in, you on Rachel Maddow, you do, you know.
You come on the Inside the Hive podcast.
You come inside the Hive podcast.
If it's booked up, you don't come on.
And you, you know, there's a checklist of issues you have to have a position on. Are you for Medicare for All? Are you not? Are you for Green for All? Are you not? And it's, you know, the establishment has its role in judging whether or not you're doing well. And I just, you know, for better or worse, I'm not ready to declare it's better or worse. Beto O'Rourke is not going to play by those rules. And he creates his own weather, right?
So are you saying that he is the standout candidate right now?
I'm not saying I know enough in politics to know that on any one day, it's never quite the way it feels on that day over the long term.
Yeah.
So, but I think that I now sort of see different paths this could take. And I think these are the questions of the 2020 campaign is like, is policy going to matter? You know, because for example, I saw this morning in one of the networks that does their early morning email sort of tip sheets listing all of the issues that Beto O'Rourke hasn't weighed in on, you know, and frankly, I wish she would. And be more, you know, personally mm-hmm. as a voter, like I'd like specifics. But I'm not sure that it's going to, I don't know if it's going to matter to him. You know, I don't know if voters care about issues because they're focused on solutions or if they hear politicians' positions on issues as a means of telling as the voter absorbing who that person really is and whether or not they can trust them, whether that person's going to fight for them. And I'm, you know, it's possible the details are going to matter a lot. I have a sense from having lived through 16 and watched 2020 thus far that a lot of times where you stand on an issue just allows people to put you in a certain camp. Like, okay, well, she's for Medicare for all. She's for Green for all. She goes over here. And O'Rourke sort of, you know, his approach could be considered Trump-like, a virtuous Trump, but Trump-like.
In what way?
If you refuse to play by the establishment rules, they have no control over you.
So do you think that when you look at the Beto and the way he kind of went through the Texan yeah. Senate race and so on, I've heard people that have said he's the greatest politician since Ronald Reagan on the Democratic side,
right.
and others that say he's a terrible debater, mm-hmm. that he couldn't beat Ted Cruz,
right.
the worst person on planet Earth, maybe. How can that translate to a presidential election? If you can't beat Ted Cruz, how can you beat Donald Trump? I mean, it's
right,
like...
Right, right.
So
that's what I mean by, you know, a politician who played by sort of established rules would say, well, I just lost a Senate race. I can't run for president. I just was rejected. And what he is saying is, no, what I did, you know, I excited a bunch of voters. I have faith in these voters and I'm going to take my show on the road. And I believe America is, that's what they want. And he might be right that that's what the Democratic primary wants. It is, you know, he's disruption come to our, he is, you know, I felt that Donald Trump was disruption come to politics
yeah.
to prove it's all broken, right?
Yeah.
So, and now it's happening on the Democratic side, maybe, you know, it's a little soon to tell. But, you know, and I said before, I think that he's well-intended. I think he's like, it's like a virtuous version of this. But it is the norms on the Democratic Party side are going to be tested now in a way that the 2016 was. You know, if I worked for Beto O'Rourke, you know, and he doesn't have people like me working for Beto O'Rourke, right? That's part of the point
yeah.
of Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah.
I would say, like, do not ever do a cable show. Like, don't ever do it. You know, he does not need to do that. Don't ever do a Sunday show. He doesn't need to do that. I was just on my way over here looking at Twitter, and Kamala Harris did a cable interview, and apparently she got asked, all the questions she got asked about were Joe Biden, three questions about Beto O'Rourke, and, you know, one about Trump. She was there to provide content for the cable show
mm-hmm.
And to answer questions to reinforce the view that Beto has momentum. Like, that is what Kamala Harris was there to do. That is messed up.
Mm.
So don't do it. And if he, you know, this is Vanity Fair's podcast. It's a great publication. I think generally, if you're, you know, if you were following established rules, somebody like Beto O'Rourke was considering running for president and said, hey, I'm going to be on the cover of Vanity Fair and Annie Leibovitz is going to photograph me. You'd say, that was a terrible idea. You're going to get so attacked for that, but he doesn't care.
Yeah.
So, and he just goes on. So if you're willing to do what Trump is, which was like, don't ever care about what the establishment thinks and don't ever play by their rules, that's where you create your own weather. Not everyone can do it. You have to have a lot of enthusiasm behind you. You have to have a particular personality that's well suited for it. And, you know, I think that, you know, as I said before, like one of the networks this morning had an email that laid out like, here's the five issues that he hasn't really weighed in on. And I was like,
he's not going to.
Nanny, nanny, boo, boo.
You are listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
If you're like me, the list of books that you want to read and those that people suggest you should read is a never-ending, constant list. You simply don't have enough time to read them all. Well, our sponsor this week, Blinkist, has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements, so you can read or listen to them in 15 minutes, all on your phone. With Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in 15 minutes than you can in any other way on your devices. I listen to Blinkist when I'm walking the dog, when I'm standing in line at the grocery store, during moments that I would have wasted time before. Instead, now I spend 15 minutes to consume a book. The Blinkist library is massive, and I mean it is massive. They have timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich, bestsellers like The Selfish Gene. I've been listening just this week to The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Culbert, which is a terrifying book, but one that you must listen to or read. Blinkist is constantly curating and adding new titles from the best of lists, so you're always getting the most powerful ideas in a made-for-mobile format. 5 million people are using Blinkist to expand their minds in 15 minutes at a time. Right now, for a limited time only, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience of Hive listeners. If you go to Blinkist.com/Hive, you can get a free 7-day trial. That is a completely free 7-day trial at Blinkist.com/Hive. That's BLINKIST.com/Hive. Get your free 7-day trial. Once again, Blinkist.com/Hive.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Hive.
Okay, so let's go through a list of all the people. No, we're not going to go through all the people running because you would be here till next week.
I know, okay.
And there'll probably be another 16 by the end of this podcast. But I do want to get your take on where you think they stand. Are you going to be involved in the 2020 election? Or is that like someone who went to war and is like, I am not going back there?
I don't feel like it's the best use of me for the best thing I could do right now.
Yes. Okay.
I'm writing another book.
So there you go.
But I mean, I love a lot of them. And there are some people there's one person who's not on the list, who I think is good too.
Okay, great. Yeah. Should we start with that person?
Because that person is Steve Bullock, governor of Montana. He has not gotten in yet.
I've read some stuff about him.
Yeah,
and
I think
it seems like he's someone who could kind of stand out from everyone else, but about it.
Yeah, I think he's somebody actually I've gotten to know through my husband. It's governor of Montana. He won twice in a state that's very difficult for Democrats to win, but he's also gotten a lot of progressive things done in that state. He passed, only state in the country to pass, Citizens United fix, got the Medicaid expansion done, things like that. So what that shows is that he has been able to prove people other than to convince people other than Democrats to be for progressive issues. And I think that's the, you know, so I think he has he'd be the only person in the race who won a Trump state. So that's sort of a unique lane. And that's, a proven ability to bring people together. So I think that he is, and I've just had the chance to get to know him, and he's just a really great guy too. Someone who I suspect would get in the race, but not for a while.
But someone like that probably has, I mean, I believe that the people who announced, you know, as soon as the first ones that announced are the ones that are going to be the first ones to go, because it's like the light shines bright and then it's like, oh, there's another shiny person over here. And it feels like with, it's very similar to 2016, you know, with Trump, who kind of came in later. Mm-hmm. He also came in with paid actors and a bunch of lies and everything else. But I don't know. We'll see. Okay, let's.
Yeah, and Democrats in particular are very susceptible to fatigue.
Yes.
So after a few months, they're going to be like, the field's terrible. Yeah. Who else is there? Which is just, Democrats are never, you know, we are never happy. We're always like worrying about the thing that we don't have.
That's really funny.
So that could happen.
All right, Cory Booker.
Yeah. I mean, I love him. See, any of these.
So, okay, so.
Catch on.
Does he have a. I'll offer my opinion.
Yeah.
You can maybe push back or agree. But I look at Cory.
Yeah.
Great guy, met him several times.
Yeah,
really cares.
Really cares.
But
that's all real. That shit is
all real. Understands technology and all the things that are important in today's media landscape, but is a little bit of a politician. In my opinion, and I just worry that he can't necessarily go toe to toe with Trump. A and B. If you know, he seems like his policies are going to be very careful, I don't know if that's something that people are going to want.
I don't know. So that's a big question. I don't know. Like, are the sort of like established norms going to hold up on the Democratic side, and we're going to demand specificity on proposals and understand what people are going to do policy wise? Are
But look at what you guys didn't. I remember looking at Hillary's 86 page report.
Yeah, but she won the primary.
Yes.
By a lot.
It's true.
You know,
it's
she,
true.
I mean, I actually, you know, this is like a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's relevant. You know, I think that 16 probably would have been better if there had been more people in the primary in the Democratic side. I think, you produce.
Well, I think part of the problem was that everyone was like, oh, Hillary's running. She's going to win. That's it.
She's going to win. That's it. And then, you know, and then when you're the uber front runner, the coverage is like, why aren't you doing better? Right? that's our coverage of 2015 in one sentence. Why isn't she doing better? And if, you know, I had like secretly hoped that Joe Biden would get in the race for the 2016 primary, because then Senator Sanders is actually a very worthy opponent of hers, but the press didn't see it that way. It's like, says he's a socialist. He's not even a Democrat. Plus he's over 70. Like, how can she not be doing well against him? But then when you have a lot of candidates in, you're able to compete, right? And compete's different. Like, that's when the sort of expectations fall away and you just see who's the best at this.
Yeah.
And so I just don't, you know, and people did want specificity, and that was a problem for Senator Sanders, that he didn't have the level of specificity that she did and wasn't quite as knowledgeable, or at least she ended up winning and that was something that she was that he wasn't. And so then I'm not sure of this year what people are going to want. You know, you can, and when you're replacing Donald Trump and you say, well, America replaces its president with the mirror image of them. Well, the mirror image of Donald Trump could be a lot of things, right? So could it be Cory Booker? Yeah. Guy that's all about love. That, you know, it could be. And that could be what Democrats, you know, that he could be some of the Democrats.
Do you think Bernie has a chance
to be the nominee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do. Do you think, isn't there a worry that he's, you know, you said before in 2016 he was 70. He's going to be.
Yeah, it's not, you know, that's not an outcome I'm hoping for. But I think it's a. You know,
do you think he can beat Trump?
I'm worried about it. Like, I'm really worried about it. Really worried. I mean, I'm really worried that I think it's going to, you know, you got to look at what state is somebody going to win that Hillary didn't win? What state is that going to be? I mean, I think if a Sanders-Trump election would be very different kind of election than we've seen before. But I worry that he would not be able to... I'm worried that would be a very polarizing election. And I think not, you know, looking beyond what's in the interest of Democrats, I think a very polarizing election is bad for the country. I think we are at the precipice of either, either we're going to find a way to our paths to come back together, or we're going to get even more divided. And I, you know, that really.
Well, I think that the answer to that depends on who the candidate is. If the candidate is a reflection of Donald Trump, then we're going to get even more divided.
Right.
If their candidate
is not, then. I worry that Sanders could be even more polarizing. I want people, you know, after the election, I was like, after Hillary lost, I thought, it's insane to think that, like, we should not go chasing Trump voters, because if somebody went in a voting booth and, like, actually pulled the lever for him, I think it's going to be really hard to convince them otherwise. And, you know, we should just get more people to vote, to bring people out. And now, I think it's hard, but I think it's important that people who voted for Trump vote for somebody else this time. I think that's, like, in the best interest of the country. I want to win that way.
The one Trump voter who is listening to the show right now, please don't vote for him.
I want to win that way. I want to win that way.
So let's talk about some of the women.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. Very smart. I have a great Kamala Harris story. You want to hear it?
I do.
This is a good story. So I was a young reporter at the New York Times, and I had moved, I think it's like 2009 or something like that. And I had moved from New York to California, to San Francisco, to cover, like, tech there. And there was this big story that a colleague and I had broken. And I sat in our bureau in the New York Times was this pathetic, like, hallway thing in this old building in San Francisco. And I was literally in the hallway next to the security reporter, this woman, Nicole Perlroth. And I called. There was a big story that we had broken about how Apple and Google were letting apps look at your photos without your knowledge. And so we called, Kamala was the attorney general at that point, and we called her office. I called her office to get a comment. And, you know, I mean, you know, you've been on the other side of that call. Like, most of the time they're like, hey, we can't comment. Or sometimes they're like, oh, we can put someone on the phone with you on background or whatever. Yeah. And the director of comms, I forget who it was like, let me see if I can get one of the lawyers just to talk to you. Maybe you can get a quote or something like that. So I get a phone call an hour later, and there's a woman who gets on the phone, and I'm asking questions, and she's explaining everything. And I'm like, at the end, I'm like, and can you tell me your name and your title and spell it for me? Just so I make sure I get it right. And and I'm literally typing as I'm saying it out loud, and I'm like, K-A-M-A-L-L-H-R. And I knew in that moment. And everyone, of course, was just staring at me with their mouth agape in the newsroom. And I was just, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. But I saw her at a lunch a few months later, and with the same reporter, Nicole, and we walked up and we went H-A-R-R. So she thought it was very funny. So that's my Kamala Harris story.
It's a good one.
It's a good story. It's an embarrassingly good one. But yes, it's a good one. So the thing I love about Kamala is that she... You're the attorney general in California. You've taken on some of these tech companies. You understand how it works. It's a state that we all love, especially when you look at the it's very liberal. Like it's but it's not too lefty.
It's really not that left. I mean,
it's not.
In its totality, it's just not lefty.
So
that lefty.
Can she, how does she rise up through you just mentioned what happened to her today. Like, how does she rise up through that to stand out? And if she was able to become the nominee, what would her strategy be to take on Trump?
Right. So, I think she is very good. You know, I know her a little bit personally and really like her a lot. I'm close with her sister, Maya, who was did the campaign, the Clinton campaign with us. And she I think that there's something special about her, which is that she's a very joyful person, right? And she's like enjoying this ride, which is not easy to do, and has a good attitude about it. But she's also very deliberate in the fights that she picks, has thought them through, and like sees a good outcome from, you know, whether that's fight she takes on in the Senate or like policy positions. And she's just very savvy about how she undertakes all of this. And she is able to be very you know, authentic is so overused, but she just puts herself out there in a way that doesn't have a lot of cloaks that I think is, good. How does she, you know, she had a great launch. You know, now you gotta get through the spring and summer is like, there's a lot of doldrums until the, debates start. But I think she could end up as a nominee.
You wrote a book, Dear Madam President, which of course is written for the first female president.
Yep.
Who do you think of all of the folks out there, Kamala, Senator Warren, mm-hmm.
Klobuchar,
like you've got all of these.
Tulsi Gabbard.
It's a lot of women that are running. Who do you think? Well, I'm not sure you will answer this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Like, who would you want to see win, and be the first female president? That's the first question.
That it's like immaterial.
but we all have someone we're rooting for. So, as I thought, you won't answer that. But
yeah, I won't answer that.
Who do you think has the best chance of beating Trump?
Well, I mean, you're not going to like this answer, but if you made it through that Democratic primary, which has a hugely talented field, and you made it through and you were the best one, you're going to be ready to take on Trump. So it's like, you know, we haven't heard people talk about Gillibrand in a while. I think she's pretty fierce. And the thing about Gillibrand is she hangs in there and she doesn't give up and she doesn't give in, and you might write her off and then you come back and there's Kirsten Gillibrand still standing. So I wouldn't count her out. Amy Klobuchar is somebody that could catch fire because, you know, a Midwesterner who wins in a red state, could do that. And, reddish sort of, Hillary did win Minnesota, but it's a tough state generally. And Warren is hanging in there playing her game, which is policy, right? You know, she's coming out, she's going to break up tech companies. So, I just don't know what the answer is, right? This is the big question, is like, what are people going to want? And you could also, there are so many people in the field, there's a lot of different lanes, and people could win their sort of heat in the primary, right? There's like the liberal heat. There's the more, you know, the like moderate people who are getting in that, you want to be the top of that. And, I could see a path where Sanders has got like 20% of support and hangs in there for him. And he's like hitting high teens each state. Sometimes that means he'll win. Sometimes it doesn't. And then people will probably end up with like three or four other folks that are, you know, seriously in it. And they're winning, quote, states with, you know, 20% support, and then what? Then you end up. Then we go and figure it out in Milwaukee.
Dun dun dun.
Yeah, is there like a brokered convention that could happen?
Is there? There states? I mean, there are states
where somebody could run the table. Someone could get in and just run the table.
Which I feel like that's what's going to happen, honestly. Personally.
And do you think that person's going to be Beto? Is that what you think?
I don't know if it's going to be Beto, but I think that there's going to be someone that stands out. And this is my prediction.
Yeah.
And we can revisit it in a couple of years when we're all put in the gulag because Trump won and created a totalitarian state. My theory is that there is either someone out there who hasn't entered the race, or maybe we haven't even heard of. Like, we've heard of, but someone just so unlikely. That person will come in at the 11th hour and figure skate their way through. Mm-hmm. Or there is one person who's just going to go run the table, as you say. But
look, I don't know if it doesn't seem like, I mean, I do. And I also, like I said, like, you know, any one moment you can get carried away. It's like, it's never as worse or as bad or as good as it seems. But it seems hard to run the table when you have, I mean, we got quality folks in the race, you know, it's not, It's a lot of, but it, you know.
Do you think, do you worry that one of my least favorite people these days, because I just think that his rhetoric is just asinine, but do you think Howard Schultz is going to destroy anything? Is he going to have an impact running as an independent? And I mean, he just sounds so ridiculously out of touch. It's insane.
It's insane. Right? Does
he have an impact, do you think?
The arrogance to think that, like, that you can do anything because you did one thing well.
Yeah. Well, that's the arrogance of billionaires.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a billionaire. I know this. So,
I don't think so. I don't think he doesn't seem to have any sort of constituency, right? I'm not sure. I'm not just like among Democrats. Who is gonna? He has shown no ability to draw any support.
He just showed an ability to get some attention in the beginning, and now it's kind of
sure he can get attention because it's great. You know, it's great copy. It's great television
but
show.
But wasn't that Trump?
But he was feeding into something real, right? He was like, he was giving value to a bunch of people that
had been disenfranchised. And there are not a lot of disenfranchised billionaires, is what you're saying.
I don't think there's a lot of disenfranchised folks that, you know, that are like worried about, that just have like where he's coming from. It's just, I just don't see him.
Yeah. All right. Well, last few questions, and we will let you get back to it. Do you, when you look at the race that Hillary ran in 2016, there was a lot of criticism around like some of the states that weren't visited.
Right.
Does that change? I mean, do they become like battlegrounds at this point? These middle states that could go blue or red?
Sure. So that would be Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Those are the three states that we lost that Democrats don't normally lose.
Yeah.
The thing is, winning Michigan and Wisconsin doesn't help you if you still lose Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And like we put everything we had into Pennsylvania and we lost it. So I think that, you know, what I had seen happening like in 15, it was like, wow, we should be spending time in Texas, Arizona, and Georgia. Those are interesting places. Those are play for the future, don't play for the past. So I think that those three states in particular stand out as places to, I think a Democrat can win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, particularly Michigan and Wisconsin. Again, Pennsylvania, it ain't easy, friends. You all think, people think, like, go spend some time there. Western Pennsylvania is tough.
You know what
else is tough? Florida.
Oh, Florida's tough just because it makes nothing about Florida makes any sense.
People think Florida, we're in California. People in California think Florida is Miami. Florida is Gainesville. Florida is Tallahassee.
It is Broward County.
It is the deep south up north. It is tough. So, you know, relying on a traditional map, I think, is very risky. And so Texas, Arizona, Georgia, those seems like places that you can grow in. North Carolina is another place that Democrats could probably win that they lost before. And I think Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan could be gotten back. But moreover, I really want presidential candidates to go to every state. And I see a lot of the Democrats like spending time in Mississippi right now, which happens to be the state I was born in, because they want to win the Democratic primary there. But, you know, that has the highest state of African-American population per capita in the country. And like Democrats never go there. That's pretty crappy. And you want, you know, you're going to be president of the whole country. And so even if people aren't going to vote for you, you should want to talk to them. You should certainly want to listen to them. And I think that people in other, you know, other parts of the country will appreciate that you went everywhere. So even if you, I would invest in those three states I talked about, Texas, Arizona, and Georgia, but I would go everywhere.
Do you believe that there are specific issues that will be the issues for 2020? I mean, will climate change be the issue? Will tech be the issue? Or will it just be revolving around Trump?
In the primary, the general?
Either
I'm
or.
I'm not sure. I think that in the, I don't, I think in the primary, I don't think that there'll be one issue that will, I don't see the issue, the one issue that would emerge in the primary. I will tell you in the general, the thing that really concerns me that looms over all of this is abortion.
Abortion.
Yeah.
And
that is what it's all about. when I get super meta and I step all the way back and think about, you know, if this time that we're living through in America is a result of, you know, centuries of inequality, including, you know, women, to some degree being disenfranchised, that fight over abortion, over a woman's body, that it is, you know, that could be the ultimate battle here. And that is among the reasons that Clinton lost, for sure. For sure, for sure, for sure. People who didn't like Trump voted for him because this issue is so important to them. And I don't say that dismissively. I say that with respect for how deeply they care about that issue. Well, but it is a...
But I can say,
big deal.
I will say dismissively, why is it that you're voting for a man to decide what a woman can do with their body?
Well, that's their view. I mean, I don't agree with their view, and I don't respect that position, but I don't discount, I understand, like, people really, you know, I understand people really, really, there are some people who really care about that, and they are willing to put everything else aside because of that.
I think
that there are more of us in America that think that that decision belongs with a woman and trust her to make the, you know, right decision for her. And I think there is more of them. But that's what concerns me. I feel like it's sort of like looming. That's what I fear is in the offing for the general election. And it is among the reasons why it's troubling is because it is an issue where people are willing to put aside their concerns about Trump
and the economy and Russia and North Korea and all of it.
Because for people, it's like that's one of the most important things in their life.
And RBG, we don't think can stick around for another.
It's her birthday today.
Is it? Oh, yes. I love RBG. She really is incredible.
It's really remarkable. Really is. Great to say. True.
All right. So.
What else?
Last question. Okay.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
I am running for president. Announcing that on Inside the Hive. I actually can't run for president. I'm British, but I am running for president.
Are you still British? You're not an American citizen?
I'm an American citizen, but you have to be born in America.
Oh, I forgot. Ah. Lord. Right.
Okay. I was about to make you my campaign director, but
now that you don't know that I can't run for president,
you're fired. Thank you very much. Yeah. No, but let's pretend for hypothetically that you are, you're in charge of my campaign. And what is the advice you're going to give me to tell me that I should, how I'm going to win? Like, what is the tactic that I take?
What is the tactic that you take?
What do I do? Do I take the Beto route of not standing with everyone else? Do I take on Trump? Do I ignore Trump? Do I focus on Iowa or New Hampshire? Uh-huh. Like, what do I do?
Well, I think it's a different answer for everybody else. But for you, I'd say like, oh, okay. Well, your value is like you are a total outsider who is willing to say truth and without a lot of concern about consequences. And that should be what you always do. And you're going to do well because you're going to like upset it at the conventional way that people run for president.
And because I can't run for president and I don't think I would ever want to because it sounds awful, quite frankly. But can that be applied to other candidates or do they all have to kind of take a different approach based on
who they are? No, they have to, because I think the best candidates understand at their core why they're doing this, have a good reason for doing it, and they run a campaign that makes sense based on the experience that they have. So I really do think that it's different for every person. And, you know, you can't just say like, oh, I'm going to do it just like Trump, because that worked for him. It wasn't like Trump was so... Trump? Did it come Trump? It wasn't that Trump was so such a technical genius in figuring out how to use Twitter, is that he said outrageous things on Twitter, and so they got picked up and they drove the news cycle, right?
He's a media genius. I don't think he's a genius at anything, but I think he is a genius at manipulating and understanding the media.
He understood that this was a very broken system, and he understood how to get in and pervert it and make it work for him. That's what but not everyone is able to do that, because not everyone is able to break every single rule of convention and, you know, tradition and laws and good taste and morality and truth, right? So then you're not, his strategy ain't going to work for you.
Do you think the 2020 there is more at stake in 2020 than there was in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's embarrassing to say it's the most important presidential campaign of our lifetime, but I think that withstanding 4 years of Trump is one thing. Withstanding 8 years of Trump is very, it's really, I worry a lot about how our institutions, I do look at the generations that are coming up behind us and think that bodes well. People's, you know, seem to be getting more tolerant. Understanding that they're entering a very different world than the one that I did, and that they have to prepare for it differently, and, you know, some semblance that at least education systems need to change to adapt for that, and hopefully they will soon. But, you know, what's going to be here by the time they're of age to, like, really make the, you know, he's gone and make the world work again? What shape are our institutions going to be? They need to go through changes, right? Everybody's have, like, unless your system was built in the last 5 years, it doesn't make any sense in the internet age, right? Like, every power system has to be rethought through, redone. So that's what's happening in democracy, right? We're going through that revolution now, and either American democratic systems are strong enough that they'll make it through.
Do you think they are?
They've held up better than I thought they would. So.
I agree with that too. I was in DC a year and a half ago, kind of at the height of Trump chaos, and everything has been Trump chaos. But there
was
this
particular.
It was
like, why are you?
It was a particularly chaotic time, and I remember I was going to a meeting at the Senate, the Dirksen Building, and I was sitting outside the Capitol, and I was looking at these buildings, and I was like, can they survive this? Like, can this democracy and these structures and the people make it through? And so far, knock on wood, it's looks like it's still kind of hanging on there.
And what's most encouraging is the new Congress.
Yes.
What's most encouraging is the, you know, the freshman members of Congress that I see that are like using their levers of power to do what Congress was supposed to do, which is like really hold the administration accountable. And you see, you know, and it's not just Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's a lot of the freshmen that are like extraordinarily well-prepared going in to the hearings and having, and really like hitting a nerve and making moments. And also creating good policy debates because they're putting new ideas forward. That is what Congress is supposed to do. I am so relieved to see
it's incredible.
Get rejuvenated.
It's incredible.
In that way.
Yeah, it's
like,
as I said, you know, on the show last week about AOC, like, what is so amazing is that she's a real human being who cares about real issues and has the ability to affect change and is doing so. You know, it's so heartwarming to see people like that in government. You know, it's amazing. So hopefully,
and have people that look like them and young people and like look and see, it is my government. That is my representative, literally.
I will say, if I ever had to say one nice thing about Donald Trump, is that if he gave us anything, it's the fact that you don't need to go the traditional route to do it. And I think that, like, let's...
Yes.
Thank you, Donald. You fucking lunatic. last question. Do you think he'll get impeached or no?
Impeached?
Do you think that they'll at least bring impeachment proceedings?
Yeah, I think he will.
You do?
Because I do. I think that when the Mueller report comes out, it is going to be worse than we expected, because every time we get a glimpse at what Mueller, like, facts Mueller has, they're worse than we thought they're going to be. And I think when that hits air, when that report gets oxygen, it's going to be so bad that the Democrats will do their job, which is to hold the President of the United States accountable, because that's what Congress is supposed to do. And in doing the normal course of their job, not for any political reason, they will find that he needs to be impeached. And
you believe that the Republicans will get behind it or no?
Well, they don't need to in the House.
Well, in the House, but it doesn't do anything.
I know. I mean, just you asked if he got impeached.
Okay, got it.
I worked for Bill Clinton. I know the difference between getting impeached and then what happens after and being removed from office.
Yeah,
they're different things.
Yes. Yes. Good point.
And then the Republican Senate, I don't know. if they will, you know, support for President Nixon hung in there until June. Republicans hung in with there until June of 1974. And that's when support started to crater for him. And he was out by August 8th, right? So it can happen quickly. I think that's everything about how these folks have behaved tells us that's not likely.
Well, to throw that stat back at you, after Nixon was impeached, the Republicans lost 54 seats the following election cycle. So
right.
They're just thinking about themselves. So, but we'll see.
So far, the lesson that they have taken away from the Nixon experience is hang in there with your guy.
Yeah.
Now that might be. It may have been worse. They may have had lost even more seats if they had hung in there with Nixon. We don't know. But I do. You know, a lot of people are like, it's bad politics for the Democrats to do this. It'll cause chaos and disruption. And I think that everybody, like where we got into trouble. Part of the reason we got in trouble in 16 was like everybody was gaming out what they thought was going to happen and basing their decisions in mm-hmm. the electoral and political process based off of that. And that's like not good.
Yeah. Right?
That's we have all these unintended consequences. So everybody should do their job. Congress's job is to hold him accountable. And if he deserves to be impeached, they should. Then Congress should do that. And I would like the country and the world to see when something like this, when some sort of virus like Donald Trump hits the United States system, we have a means of dealing with it.
Let's hope. What's your book, your new book about? Are you allowed to talk about
it? It's more about women. Nice. It will come out in the spring of 2020. And it's going to, it's framed as a declaration of independence that declare Great. Yourself independent from like the world that came before us. We're starting a new one.
Great. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us again.
So fun, Nick.
You'll have to come back when your book comes out.
Yeah, next year. Next April.
Get writing.
Seriously.
Thanks to my guest today, Jennifer Palmieri. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Don't forget to leave a review while you're there, or I'll be really upset, and you don't want me upset because that's just not fun. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thank you, of course, to my sponsors, Groa and Blinkist. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week.
Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.